I will call the meeting to order. We do have a quorum. And do we have minutes? Someone would like to move the minutes of the... What date is that?
Still moving, Mr. Chair.
January 22nd. Representative Abler moves the minutes from January 22nd.
My mom will know I was here then. See, I'll be in the minute.
Okay. They spelled your name right, Jim.
Oh, good.
So, any discussion on the minutes? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? So, we have adopted the minutes. And today we're going to start the budget hearing, and we're going to hear from the Department of Health. But before we do that, I want John Walls to explain to us how we read these budget pages. So, John, if you could find a good page and tell us to turn there and...
Mr. Chair, I think if members want to pull out the packet with the MDH letterhead on the front with their transmittal letter and turn to page H4. And Mr. Chair, beginning on H4, you see the different direct appropriations within the Department of Health, and this is just to give you an idea of what the governor is doing. The first would be for the general fund, which is most important to this committee and our budget conundrum. The general fund, you can see that it shows the current 08 and 09 biennial, or the current 08 and 09 numbers for the biennium that we're in and what was budgeted. And if you look in the next column for the governor's recommendation under 10 and 11, the numbers get smaller. And the numbers in the brackets are how much is being reduced in each year. The details which follow on future pages. For other funds such as the petroleum tank release cleanup, there's no reduction. I believe that $1,000 was probably a one-time appropriation. But for state government special revenue, there's some addition there in the governor's recommendation for health care access.
John, could you explain the special revenue to the newer members?
Mr. Chair, members, state government special revenue is not general revenues from the state from income and sales taxes. They generally are fee-based, and these may be fees that are charged for, say, health inspections or something like that. And when those fees increase, there's more money available for expenditure, or, you know, some of the recommendations may be increasing the fee to meet the department's costs of providing a service or something like that. I'm not sure how the 1.6 breaks out in particular, but that, you know, that's sort of the workings of the fund and how expenditures are made from it. The Healthcare Access Fund, you can see the governor has made some reductions there. Miscellaneous special revenue, that's sort of been...
Just to remind the members, in the Department of Health budget, the Healthcare Access Fund just funds some activities in the Department of Health, but the Human Service budget contains the part of the Healthcare Access Fund that actually funds Minnesota Care. So this is just money that's transferred from the Healthcare Access Fund to the Health Department to run certain activities. So I think they'll come.
And Mr. Chair, that's basically how one would read page H4, just looking at sort of an overall broad picture of the different funds that are appropriated to the department, and just a broad picture of whether or not the governor is recommending an increase or decrease in their expenditure. Going on to the next page, we have things broken down at carry forward. These are items where an appropriation may be made to an agency for state technology, and they have authority to, if those funds are unexpended, to carry those forward into a future biennium. Direct appropriations are appropriations that are made by the committee through an act in legislation. Open and statutory appropriations are appropriations for funds where there's perhaps a revenue source, and they have the authority to go ahead and use that money as it comes in, and these are generally for special duties that the agency has to perform. And then you have expenditures by category broken down, and then expenditures by program. Under the last section on page 85, expenditures by program, policy, quality, and compliance is the one area that is under the jurisdiction of this committee. Those other areas are under the jurisdiction of Representative Clark's health committee. Housing and Public Health is the title, Mr. Chair.
For those that don't know, the parts of the Department of Health that are in this committee are basically the healthcare economics and those things that regulate healthcare providers like hospitals or nursing homes. Those kinds of things are in this committee, and I'm sure when they Department of Health testifies, they will explain that to us. Go ahead, John.
Mr. Chair, just turning to page 6, then we have a change summary. And this is, again, broken down by fund. You can see the little sort of areas where it's broken down to general fund, petroleum, tank relief, cleanup fund, state government special revenue. But it just has a line-by-line item of the different governor's initiatives, whether there's additional spending or a cut, which would be indicated by numbers in brackets. And that's basically the way you would read that page. The following page is also part of the change summary as well. And, Mr. Chair, then the following pages are just the detail sheets as to those line items where the governor is recommending changes, either positive or negative. Mr. Chair, I guess, unless there's any questions.
Nope.
That was
any questions for Mr. Walls? Representative Abler.
I have a couple on H5, the carry forward. This is the top of that column there. There's some numbers there, and then there's 0 and 010-11. Does that mean that those carry forwards remain intact? Or are they captured for the bottom line? That's a 0.
Mr. Chair, Representative Abler, I'm actually a little gray on how that's being represented in this chart, and I would probably leave that question to the department.
Okay, now I have another question. We have the change pages, and I was reading the budget last night because I had nothing better to do than read 357 pages. I didn't quite get done, but those are the changes. Is there some way to find out what wasn't changed? Is there maybe some programs that we don't like as well as some that were changed that we could look at to scrutinize better?
We'll send that to the members. But what we deal with in when the department makes their presentations are the changes they're making, and unfortunately, a lot of times we ignore what's back in the regular bigger part of the budget. And so you need to remember that there are other things that we're funding that maybe we don't want to fund. Okay, any other questions? Would the Department of Health want to start their presentation?
So do we want to start, Mr. Chair? Or?
We were discussing your cane.
Mr. Chair, I apologize. I have a medical condition requiring this, but I'd be happy to explain after this hearing. But if nothing else, I thought it would generate a little sympathy among the committee as well.
Good luck with that.
Yeah. Thank you for the opportunity, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, to come back and present the governor's recommendations for the Department of Health budget and the coming biennium. I'm Craig Akam. I'm the Chief Financial Officer of the Department. With me today is Scott Light, Assistant Commissioner of the Department of Health. Just by way of background, before I present our budget, you know, the governor presented his budget recommendations yesterday in a press conference at 1 o'clock. You know, I think that he framed the conversation in an interesting way. He said that, you know, 2 years ago when this body adjourned, we had a $34.6 billion biennial budget. And this year, we are looking at a $31.9 billion budget based on revenues expected to receive. The economy back then was growing at 2.1%. The economy is expected to shrink now by 2.5%. And there's approximately 55,000 Minnesotans who are not working, who were working then. And so I, you know, certainly express the regrets of our commissioner who could not be here today, but I'd like to share with you her letter, which is included in your packet, which I think frames the conversation and choices that were made at the Department of Health in light of this economic situation. As you're aware, the Minnesota consistently ranks in the top four as one of the healthiest states in the nation, thanks to our commitment in public health and the strength of our unique state-local partnerships. MDH employs a variety of program models and strategies in the pursuit of our mission to protect, maintain, and improve the health of all Minnesotans. Additionally, our policies reduce overall costs by focusing on immediate interventions and long-term prevention. We approach this work through core agency values of integrity, collaboration, science, and accountability. Also important are our close partnerships with local public health departments, tribal governments, the federal government, other state agencies, and many health-related organizations. MDH faces a variety of new concerns in the coming biennium. These include increasing demand for services with decreasing financial resources, growing public concern about new emerging health threats, and maintaining our focus on long-term prevention and reform goals in the midst of immediate short-term needs. The following pages reflect the difficult economic times facing the state in the coming biennium and contain strategies MDH believes will address the fiscal realities facing our agency while still accomplishing our goals. These strategies support our recently refocused agency strategic priorities, healthcare reform, focus on prevention, risk factors, and public health threats. There are three strategic themes to incorporate across our strategic priorities: eliminating health disparities, aligning with and influence the changing culture, and use economic conditions for health advantage. We're establishing improved goals and performance measures to accompany these priorities and themes to ensure our progress for cost-effective outcomes for all Minnesotans. MDH is committed to finding new and innovative ways to accomplish our mission, and we look forward to working with you on our biennial budget so that all Minnesotans can continue to live in one of the healthiest states in the nation. So, Mr. Chair and committee members, we've spent a considerable amount of time last week going through our base budget, and so I am sure that all of you are familiar with our programs under the jurisdiction of this committee. And as Mr. Walls pointed out, only the Policy, Quality, and Compliance Bureau is germane to this committee's work. And so what we've done is we've pulled out the change pages that pertain specifically to this committee, and I'd like to walk through those now. So if you could open your packets and turn to H9. We have a few critical investments that are part of the governor's budget. The governor is recommending funding $550,000 a year from the general fund to provide stable funding for the behavioral risk factor surveillance system. This is a survey that is done in all states, including Minnesota. It's basically a telephone-based survey, but it's one of our primary tools for interpreting the risk factors affecting populations across Minnesota. And in addition, we've had a funding decrease from the federal government in response in regards to this program. Our match requirements are going up. And we also are unable, at our current level of funding activity, to ascertain key information around disparities, including race, ethnicity information, and geographic information. And so we feel that this investment will help to bolster all of our programs, including our soon-to-be-enacted SHIFT program, our Limiting Health Disparities Initiative, and other chronic disease initiatives that we have in the department by providing critical information to all of our programs on the status of risk facing the population here in Minnesota. The next initiative is the HE Health Initiative on page H11. The governor is recommending $350,000 per year in base funding for the Center for Health Informatics to ensure that statutory mandates are achieved. As this committee is aware, 2 years ago, as part of the governor's initiative, part of his package was to include funding for our e-health initiative to meet target deadlines for e-prescribing by 2011 and use of electronic health records by 2015. That money is coming to an end at the end of this biennium. And while part of that funding also included grants and loans, the key part of that funding was to staff the Center for Health Informatics, which provides the direction, oversight, and overall capacity for the state around managing the e-health initiative. Part of its mission is to set the standards, provide technical assistance, ensure that targets and goals are being met. And without this funding, we have no way to continue this effort and provide that expertise at the Department of Health. And so the governor is recommending a minimal amount of funding to maintain that office and that center to allow the e-health initiative to continue forward. As a result of the economic situation and economic conditions, the Department of Health was also forced to look at some difficult choices in terms of funding reduction. And if you turn to page H13, I can start going through those.
Mr. Chair, over here.
Representative Edwards.
Before we get too far into some of these, in the past we've had FTEs that were counted somewhere. Is that part of the paper, or is that something we just have to ask each time, or can you kind of tell us that?
I don't know if it's in here, Mr. Chair, Representative Abler, but I'd be happy to answer that question. For the e-health initiative, there are currently 4 staff members who are part of that Center for Health Informatics. They are existing staff members. This is continuing their positions and their funding to avoid losing that technical expertise. In terms of the BRSSS, which is the Behavioral Risk Factor Surveillance Survey, most of that work is contracted out.
Thank you.
The next change item that the governor recommends is reducing the statewide health improvement program by half, from $47 million to $24 million. However, we are spreading the program out from 2 years to 4 years. And while this initially may seem to be a reduction in effort, it actually provides some benefits to our partners in terms of having a longer-term base from which to implement these system and policy and strategic initiatives to ensure the long-term effect of this initiative. As a non-implemented program, we're thrilled that this program is still in the budget. And it reflects, and the fact that it is, reflects that it's a top priority of our agency. So I can understand, though, where there may be some concern among members regarding that reduction. But in light of the current economic situation and economic factors facing the agency, we feel that this will still allow us to achieve our goals, but meet our fiscal responsibilities to balance our budget.
Well, Mr. Akam, Governor's Transformation Task Force recommended actually more money than the $47 million that we put in there, which would have saved us about 10% of our healthcare spending by 2015. And the bill that we passed, the $47 million one that's over this next biennium, would have saved approximately 6% of healthcare spending in the state. And now you're going to delay the impact of that by some significant amount. And if we're going to somehow eventually, or I mean, we don't want to do it eventually. We have to get control of healthcare spending. And the whole initiative that we passed last year was to get that done as fast as possible. And now you're telling us you're going to delay that attempt to get control of healthcare spending.
Mr. Chair, I think that in any budget exercise, we need to balance the resources that are available with the goals that are desired. And while I can appreciate your comments in terms of wanting to expedite those savings and that effort, the fact of the matter is there were some very difficult choices to be made in the Health and Human Services budget, as I'm sure we will reflect and with as our sister agency, Human Services, will reflect on. And so we feel this is a good compromise solution.
Representative.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And it has struck me, listening to the discussion about the health and Health and Human Services budget from the governor's perspective, that really the only thing he says is it's unsustainable cost growth, which is true in the private market just as much as it is in the public market. So if that's his top goal, is to bring that down, I guess there's two ways he can do it. One is just to throw everybody off the program, which is, I guess, the course he's chosen. The other is to actually bring down the cost. This seems totally contrary and going absolutely against the governor's own perspective on wanting to control the growth in healthcare spending, and I really don't understand why we would move in this. And I also would like to ask, that's, I guess, the comment part, but I also like to ask what $6 million is going to do. I mean, have you even calculated, is it worth even spending $6 million a year? Do you have any understanding what the outcomes of that $6 million is going to do statewide?
Mr. Chair, Representative Steeson, basically we projected savings based on the program at $47 million. You can imagine that it is probably a linear reduction in terms of savings with the reduction in effort. And so we can certainly do that analysis. We haven't done it yet. I think that, you know, the key to implementing this program and moving forward at this reduced amount of money is not to reduce the per capita amount that we had intended to invest in each of our projects and each of our grantees, but probably to reduce the number of grantees to maybe 10 or 12, rather than having it be, you know, a broader range of grantees and a broader scope of work. I would just say that I think that still at this investment, we're going to see some savings, and still at this investment, we have a platform from which to build on.
So, but you haven't, Mr. Chair, you haven't done any analysis of what those savings would be. It strikes me as doubtful two things. One is that there actually is a linear connection between the amount of investment you make and not. That seems to me to be not right. And secondly, I guess what I'm understanding you're saying is what was the precursor program that was in four states, four cities? How much did we spend on that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Keeson, the steps program which you're referring to was approximately $2.1 million.
For the four cities. So we'll be able to do about 12 cities around the state instead of the whole state. Okay. And we're going to pick and choose those, how?
They'll still be, Mr. Chair, Representative Keeson, they'll still be through a competitive RFP process.
And what are you going to be judging in terms of assessing what's competitive? I mean, are you look at the needs of the communities, or are you going to look at the effectiveness of the programs proposed?
Mr. Chair, Representative Keeping all of the above. And so we have actually a full package which will be coming out on February 9th, which will outline the details of how we're grading the proposals.
I don't want to spend much time on. I don't know how much time you want to spend on this. Is it at some point it might be worthwhile to bring down the person that is actually in charge of this program to talk about this as well? But we can finish up. We can go through this maybe at the end.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Peason essentially, articulated my point. I do want to say that I believe to the testifiers that this is probably not the direction the health department is eager to go. But when I read through this last night, it just, you know, reminded me of, you know, when we think about where we are in terms of the economy and healthcare costs as such a fundamental part of where we are in terms of the economy and the good effort that we together put forth to try and put our hands around that and then, you know, undercutting that dramatically is just a contradiction that I can't not call attention to in the hearing. Thank you.
Well, Representative Murphy, I received a phone call yesterday morning from the CDC complimenting the state of Minnesota for what they were proposing to do, and the person from the CDC told me that all America was watching Minnesota because of this program, and unfortunately, they are watching Minnesota, and they're going to see what the governor has recommended, which is a cut. Representative Thiessen, do you want to ask questions to the person that's in charge of this program? We can do that now.
Well, why don't we, it's up to you, but why don't we go continue on?
Okay.
Thanks,
Mr. Aikum.
Mr. Chair, members, thank you. Just one last comment about SHIP. Even at this reduced level, we still believe that Minnesota will be a leader nationally in terms of its efforts, and so you know, we're very hopeful to continue the work and show the results that will prove the success of this program.
Well, let me add just one other comment. In the United Healthcare rankings of states, we dropped from first to fourth or second to fourth, I'm not sure which, and the main reason we dropped was because of our lack of spending on public health activities.
Mr. Chair, apparently the cane is not working, so.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Broad.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that we're going to have all sorts of opportunities to wax and wane about all sorts of important things. But I'd be interested in if the committee could provide, if you, Mr. Chair, could provide the committee with some more information related to those rankings. I think it's really interesting to suggest that the rankings dropped because of one program. And it's interesting to suggest that Minnesota is being watched because of one program. I think that there's probably a heck of a lot of things out there that we're being watched for. And because, and so I think we got to be careful about how we move forward in terms of the rhetoric as we make these very tough decisions. We're going to have rhetoric. You're going to have rhetoric. We're going to have all sorts of that. But there's a heck of a lot that goes into that, more than just one program.
We can. I'll have that page sent to you. Mr. Aikum.
Mr. Chair, thank you. The next item on page H15 of your packet has to do with our health reform bill that was passed this last session. The governor is recommending replacing the activities associated with defining an essential benefit set with a less expensive study on value-based insurance design utilizing our existing health economics program research capacity. This obviously would also be one of the studies that we do for the legislature. It would be in place of doing that. So,
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the testifiers. I'm just wondering if you can talk a little bit more about what the difference between essential benefits set and value-based insurance design is. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, what the legislation passed last year was really about building was a working with the community to sort of define an actual benefit set. That is to say, what should be included in covered services for insurance policies. Some criteria were listed in the bill itself that we were to look at in developing those recommendations for the benefit set, including things like providing coverage for a broad range of services and technologies that is based in science and provides differential cost sharing. for people who are using services that have been determined to be either scientifically or cost-effective. The essential benefits that really encapsulate that approach, which is that it's what needs to be included in the entirety of a benefit set. And past efforts at this, we've tried to do this on several different occasions in the past. There was an attempt in the early 1990s via something called the Universal Standard Benefit Set, or the USBS set. Ends up, because of the lack of scientific evidence around what should be included, what ends up in essential benefits is essentially that everything ends up being included because we don't have a lot of good evidence. What a value-based benefit set tries to drive more at is to take those things where we know we do have good, very good solid evidence, and to build in incentives for enrollees to use those services that we know to be cost-effective, or to use those providers that we know to be cost-effective and quality-effective. There's a slight, it's a subtle distinction, but a real distinction in the sense that the value-based piece really tries to drive more at providing those incentives to for people to seek care in higher quality, less costly settings, based on whatever evidence we know. Essential benefits really, since we know not as much as we would like about the effectiveness of certain services, tend to be broader benefit sets that tend to be different.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Lights, is it fair to say then that this is both a change in terms of the budget and a change in terms of policy approach?
Mr. Chair and Representative Murphy, we actually believe, based on the discussions that occurred last year via the Legislative Commission, the Governor's Transformation Commission, and discussions here at the Legislature as health reform moved forward last year, that the value-based benefit set, I think, very closely mirrors a lot of those discussions that were occurring, which is, how do we do a better job of building benefit sets that represent the science of what we know about effectiveness of certain conditions? So, I guess we would say that this actually sticks closely to what the policy discussions were last year and gets at some of those issues.
Representative Murphy.
Just one final question. Can you talk about the budgetary change that's attached to this? So we're still going to pursue this other thing, and there's a cost savings. Can you describe that?
Mr. Chair and Representative Murphy, there was an appropriation last year to do the work around the essential benefit set, primarily because the process that was envisioned was a broad work group process that would involve essentially from the bottom up building a benefit set, involving actuarial work, involving the involvement of a wide scope of stakeholders, and that's reflected in the $540,000 appropriation for this to do that work. This work would be would still involve those stakeholders in the consultative role, and would not be though building from a base up. Rather, we would be taking a look at what do we know from other states' experiences in building value-based benefit sets, and what do we know from the literature about what things are actually lend themselves to being built into a value-based benefit set. So it's a slightly different approach. It's coming at it more less from the bottom up and more from an angle, if you will, and that relates to the budgetary difference. We believe we can do this work within the existing resources of the Health Economics Program. They have some standing capacity to do that work, and we believe that could be done within that existing appropriation.
Representative Bunn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a follow-up to that discussion. Typically, in a central benefit set, one would define that, and then one would want to do kind of value-based analysis on top of that, in the sense that it's defined including certain kind of preventive care and some kind of hospitalization, other kinds of things. And then within that, you'd want to do value-based analysis or form it in some way so that they would then get that care that's only evidence-based within that category and not things that are not proven evidence-based, or that they would get that care from the highest quality, lowest cost deliverers of that care. So I don't see them. I see the value-based analysis is in addition to a task that might involve doing an essential benefit set. Given that, if I'm correct in thinking about that, what is it that would not be looked at in your value-based study? An example, so you're saying some things wouldn't be included in a value-based benefit set design. Can you give an example that would come up in the essential benefit discussion or be in a essential benefit package that would not come into most value-based packages?
Mr. Chair and Representative Bunn, I think you make I think your argument here is such, if I can just rephrase it for you, make sure I understand, is that oftentimes one thinks about an essential benefit set being built, what things do you want included, and then value-based might layer on top of that, of how do you want to differentially tier providers, or how do you want to do cost-sharing differentially based on certain services. We certainly would intend to, in the research that we're doing, both take a look at what things lend themselves to value-based benefit design, as well as what approaches other states have taken, both around value-based as well as the adequacy standards that other states have built in. So, for example, one might take a look at Massachusetts to say, under their individual mandate plans that are sold through the connector, what have they included as that base benefit set that everyone has to buy? And we could take a look at that and summarize that work for the legislature so that they understood the approaches that are being taken by a variety of states. So I think those two, I think you make a good point, and those two are not mutually exclusive, and I think both would occur.
Representative Abler.
Thanks. How many days are we going to go? Did you put aside for this discussion? for the whole thing. So, all right. I'm just curious. But I'll try to ask
as long as it takes, Representative
Abler. I'm not trying to ask very many questions. But just to remind the department that one of the concerns I had about this, and there's a number, but just at the end of the day, you've got buy-in to what you do. And so I hope as you choose the stakeholders that there's a lot of stakeholders and they all get the input. And the department seems open to that, but I just wanted to remind them that if you have a product that nobody believes in, it's all just a nice exercise. So.
Representative Eason.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. If I'm understanding this correctly, though, you're not going to come back with any recommendations, which the other would have come back with. You're just going to provide a memo to us that summarizes what's going on in the research in other states.
Mr. Chair, Representative Cheatham, I think what we would do is to summarize the research, discover what's going on in other states, and to the extent that they run themselves to recommendations, bring those back to you.
Mr. Chair, but not recommend actually what a benefit set would look like or what a value-based benefit set would look like.
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair and Representative Cheatham, it would be unlikely that we would come back describing the specific single benefit set. Under the original study, there would have been elements of that, but I think that we would likely have presented in that original study also some choices for the legislature to make around certain things as well. So there would be a slight difference between what we're describing here and what the original was in that sense.
Okay, Mr. Chair, thank you. It sounds a little bit more than slight, but we don't have to quibble about that. And the reason I'm asking the question, it also says, basically, there's kind of a rule of thumb here that you can do one or two studies within your own appropriation each year. And so ultimately, you're kind of lumping this one in that kind of set-aside money that we've already set aside. And so the question becomes whether it's worth doing this kind of study at all versus doing some other kind of study. Would that be accurate? As a policy decision?
Mr. Chair, Representative Keith, and the governor's proposal would be to use that a standing capacity to conduct that analysis.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Abler.
I'm still trying to be minimal, but as I just read this, I'm not seeing this until today, actually. It seems that Representative Keith and others, that if we're going to move down this road, this might be some good preliminary work to really set the stage for a future work group to actually dig in on some of the stuff that they figure out. And so maybe the money might be better spent in the next year after this. If they come back or something, and if it looks for $500,000, this might be a good pot of money to just put off one time. So and maybe it's productive. So.
Okay. Continue, Mr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If you go to the next page on 817, the governor is recommending the elimination of two non-base grants. One is the Community Healthcare Demonstration Grant, and the other is a Merck grant specifically to the Mayo Clinic. Back in 2007, the legislature appropriated money, $212,000 per year, to fund a demonstration program, a five-year demonstration program, in Carlton, Cook, Lake, and St. Louis County. I know that the chairman is very familiar with this program. Last session, that amount was reduced, as were all the grants of the Department of Health, by 1.8% to $208,000 per year. The program ends in December 21st of 2012. This recommendation would sunset that program early. The other grant that's being sunset early is also back in 2007 was a distribution formula change to the Merck program. As a result, the Mayo Clinic received less money, but was awarded some general fund dollars to help them supplement their payments for their medical education and research costs. That money also was dropped last session from $6.25 million and $4.2 million in 2009. There's only $1 million per year in 10 and 11, and the grant sunsets at the end of 11. And so this would be ending both of those grant programs early.
Well, let me just comment on the last one there. I think the Mayo Clinic used to get about $10 million from Merck money. And the Merck is primarily money that goes to help institutions that have residency programs fund their programs. And formula changed, and Mayo was going to lose it all, and we put some general fund money in. And this would make it more difficult for Mayo then to do their graduate medical education. The first program is an attempt to get health care to people that don't get health care, and in a very novel way, by getting the provider community to give relatively large discounts, and then have the employees contribute some and the employer contributes some. I think it was a great program. So we'll go on and we'll discuss that as the budget comes to completion.
On the next page, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, H-19, the governor is recommending a 7.5% reduction to the Department of Health General Fund Administrative Budget. This is our non-grant dollars. This amounts to a $1.834 million per year reduction in our operations.
Any questions on that?
Representative.
So it's 20 FTEs?
And approximately. Yes.
And we do we know if those are filled positions, unfilled positions, and where those positions are going to come from? Are they going to come from doing studies that are built into your budget?
Mr. Chair, Representative Keeson, we haven't determined yet how those cuts should be allocated across the board.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Avery.
Well, this is their chance to make the pitch on how that would make their life difficult to do the job they're supposed to do. So what kind of things might this help you not to do if you lose that many people?
Mr. Chair, Representative Abler, the Department of Health, as you remember from our budget overview, probably only receives 14% of our budget out of the general fund. Of that, of two-thirds goes out in grants, and the remaining third of that $14 million, I have my numbers wrong. It was about $71 million overall in the department. What we do with that little bit of general fund money that's left is we provide the match to the greater amount of the federal funds that we bring in, which is almost half of our budget. We use that to provide the state share of our oversight of those federal programs. And we also use it to address Minnesota-specific needs through which there are no other grant sources, federal or otherwise, which may arise here in Minnesota. It's hard to say at this point how we would manage that reduction. But we're committed to doing that as part of the governor's budget.
Mr. Chair. Representative Abler, appreciate his enthusiasm for doing what they have to do. Is this a match by FFP then? Is this double in terms of the dollar effect on the department?
Mr. Chair, Representative Abler, this is not.
Okay, thank you.
Moving along, if you turn the page to H-20. We have a technical adjustment, only partially of which affects this committee's responsibility. Basically, in the session laws from last session, there was a change in the appropriations of the federally qualified health centers. That money, $1.5 million in general funds, was reduced to zero. It was replaced, however, with health care access dollars, So the funding to FQHCs was not reduced. However, because there was also a 1.8% reduction to all grants, what that left was a hole in the state budget of $27,000, because $27,000 is 1.8 of the original $1.5 million appropriation from the general fund. So as expected, as part of the savings, this technical adjustment would restore that funding.
I would remind members that the federally qualified health centers are basically spread all over the state, and they're the safety net hospitals or clinics, so important to keep them going.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Amler.
So just the lead thing, is that lead changed? Is that less than it was planned to be? I know it's leveraged with some federal money, as I recall. Is that the taking the lead out of houses program, or is that something else?
Mr. Chair, Representative Amler, the other two items, the lead abatement grant program and the emergency preparedness and response, which are part of Representative Clark's committee, the short answer to your question is yes, the program actually goes to lead abatement work done by an AmeriCorps program, and because of an error between the appropriations language and the spreadsheet, there's a shortfall in that grant program.
Ms. Chair, she'll bring that up to me. I wouldn't be there. But that's on her mind, I'm sure.
You can continue that, please.
Okay. The next four items are fee proposals related to this program or this committee's jurisdiction. On H-22, you'll see the governor is recommending maintaining a $2 surcharge on the vital records fees. That was a fee that was initiated back in 2005, basically to enhance the technology infrastructure of that program, that's our birth and death records. We have completed that implementation of that upgrade, and there's a new system in place, which has won kudos for being able to get birth and death records out much more quickly than before. However, the cost of operating this program has continued to rise since 2005 when that fee was enacted. And rather than allowing that fee to sunset at this time, the governor is recommending that that fee remain in place to continue the operations of the program.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So just so I understand, what is the actual operating expense for the program that's above current appropriations? Does it match the $1.2
million? Mr. Chair, Representative Thiessen, all of our fee programs are required to balance out. We're required by law to set fees over a 4 to 5 year window in order to balance expenditures and revenues. And so our projections going forward with our current fee structure now is that this is required at this point in order to maintain the current operation of the program.
So, Mr. Chair, so it balances up. Okay, thank you.
So next item on page H24. It's a program fee increase to our adverse health events reporting program. Originally passed in 2003, this program was meant to report 27 serious adverse events at hospitals and emergency rooms. This program provides an additional amount of money to oversee the operation of that program, which has grown in scope and magnitude since that time. By changing the fees on hospitals, changing the fees on ambulatory surgical centers, and
So raising the hospital fee $100, so that's just $500 per hospital, mm-hmm. or $600 per hospital, is that correct? Plus, for every bed they have, that's not every entry into a bed, but just the number of beds they have. Okay.
And But if you go to your
program that gets a lot of attention in the newspaper.
There were two other additional items that were handed out after we put our packet together. They are on a separate piece of paper labeled H21A and H21B. H21A is an occupational therapy duplicate license fee. In essence, the governor recommends establishing a new fee for a duplicate license of an occupational therapy license. This would be about a $25 replacement fee for that additional license. We estimate it will generate about $1,000 in revenue a year.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Are the occupational therapists losing their licenses more frequently than the other licensed professionals?
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, apparently so.
Your cane's starting to work.
It's working now. Took a little while to warm up. Mr. Chair, the last item in the governor's budget that relates to this committee for the Department of Health is on page H21B. It's a hearing instrument dispenser certification fee. Basically, we would increase our certification and examination fees plus establish a two-year surcharge. This increased revenue would address a program deficit, which we are currently facing. The certification fee would change from $350 to $700, and the exam fee would change from $500 to $1,000.
Mr.
Representative Abler.
I had a few questions about this. Is there some way that, as this moves along, I can be told how many of the costs that the department spends on this activity related to people that have properly passed the test and are regulated and those who are out of the system and are unregulated? I think that's a question you probably don't know off the top of your head. But I have, at least that's an anecdotal report. I forgot to bring it, but I was just given a copy of the form. So the brochure comes from the department. And on the back it says, if you have any questions, call. And if not specific, do you have any complaints about a licensed provider? In my board, if they complain about licensed professionals, then that's something that they do. If someone is practicing my field without a license, that's really probably their business, and so they don't do much about that. And I think that there's some activity the department does that's not related to these registered or tested individuals, and I think that these are a little dinky providers. Even though they sell a valuable product, I don't think they're getting rich, and I think that as we try to keep costs low and keep these lower cost providers open, we don't want to drive out of business. And you know, it's been an issue for me in the past, and so that would be helpful as we go along. And if indeed there's some work done by people who are not regulated, that could be a different budget item. We should award some money or take it out of carry forward or something just to get you caught up.
Mr. Chair, Representative Abler, I don't have all the answers to your questions, but I would say that hearing instrument dispensers are a regulated community. They have been since 1988. I don't know where the source of the compliance activity has been. So.
Right. Representative Stevens.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can I go back to the very first one, the behavioral risk factor thing? And just my question on that is, every state does this on their own, it sounds like. Has there been any... What impact would it have? I mean, assuming, for instance, Wisconsin's demographics are relatively similar to ours. And part of the problem, it sounds like, here is you can't get the right sample size to get it kind of more discrete population. I mean, is there a way that you could get at that problem without spending more money by kind of doing the survey over, kind of combining your resources and doing a broader survey that would include, so you'd lump the Minnesota and Wisconsin data together to get at some of those smaller populations?
Mr. Chair, Representative Thiessen, the problem, I think, in what you're describing is that the sample size is an issue in terms of the delineation of the data. But, you know, if we were to do something jointly with another state, then what we would have would be a pool of aggregate information across the two states rather than Minnesota-specific information.
No, and I, Mr. Chair, and I that I would get. I'm just wondering if another state, and I don't know what this, if it would be Wisconsin, Iowa, I suppose North Dakota doesn't look like us as much on some of these issues. I don't know that. But if the demographics are roughly the same, it wouldn't perhaps make as much difference that you're lumping two states together or three states together.
Mr.
Chair and Representative Keaton, I think the challenge and the reason that the CDC has funded this at a base level for each of the states is that there are some fundamental, there are demographics which are similar, but there are policy differences that exist between states. And part of what we're trying to get at, I think, here is the ability for us as a state to be able to examine how our state-specific risk factors have changed over time, how the policy interventions that we've put in place, which do differ from those that Wisconsin has put in place, whether those are having an impact, whether that be through our disparities initiative or through you know, the health reforms that we put in place. So I understand your point about pooling, and that does bring in a broader sample. What I think is the challenge with that is that you would lose some of the more state-specific pieces of it.
Okay. Thanks.
So, Mr. Chair, that concludes our presentation on the governor's recommendations for changes in the Department of Health budget in the coming biennium.
Are there any questions that anybody wants to ask before we bring down Cara McNulty? Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative White, I just had someone asked me to bring forth a question. And the question is, there have been nursing homes that have come through the moratorium exception process and have been granted funding through that in past years. And as we know, the financial situation is such that it's hard to get funding. And so my question is, if hospital moratorium exception has been granted to a nursing home in the past, like let's say 2007, will that be extended if they aren't able to make the June deadline because of funding issues?
Mr. Chair and Representative Pepin, I don't have the answer to your question right offhand. We'd be happy to bring that back and get an answer for you.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Abler.
And sometimes, you know, it's trouble being the chance to have opportunities. Back to this hearing aid dispenser thing, and it's just become a hobby of mine. There's 175 of them, and I'm just trying to hang on. But maybe the staff can come visit me, but maybe we should look at how they're managed anyway. And if they're generating $50,000 in fees and $90,000 in overruns, that's not tenable for either the department or for these people. Maybe we should give them their own little group that they could police themselves, or they could have to get kicked out if they get three strikes or something. But maybe there's a disparate chair who are really bad and there's some that are really good. So, but I'm willing to work on it if anybody wants to help me. Thanks.
Okay, well, thank you very much for your presentation, and would Ms. McNulty come down, please? And Representative Thiessen, do you have a question for her? If you would just state your name for the record.
Good afternoon. Cara McNulty with the Minnesota Department of Health.
Yeah, well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I can ask some questions. I guess what I'd be interested in is kind of getting a little more detail about what you think $6 million can do, and also kind of refresh my recollection about what we were doing with the STEPS program and that federal funding, and how much, as I recall correctly, there was kind of a certain amount allocated, but the department thought we actually needed more per capita allocated to make it an effective program. So it's kind of very general, but if you could walk through those two things.
Ms. McNulty. Pardon me.
Mr. Chair, Representative Keaton. The STEPS initiative, we were funded for 5 years. That funding will end this September. Four communities were funded, Minneapolis, St. Paul, Rochester, and Wilmer, to work on policy systems and environmental change across four settings, school, community, healthcare, work sites. The base per capita that CDC funded us was $3.89. That's the lowest amount they feel is effective for funding. What we then did is we took that base funding and with Minneapolis, St. Paul, Rochester, and Wilmer, we said identify your at-risk or highest risk population, your geographic challenges, and tell us your plans for implementation around interventions. So in Wilmer, they were spending a lot more than $3.89 because there's 19,000, it's a 19,000 population, and they weren't addressing everyone in Wilmer. So in Wilmer, we could say that they spent about $7. In Minneapolis, really that $3 to $5 range, depending on the year. Does that answer your Seth's question?
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's the first piece of it, but I also recall there was something about us talking about that 3 to 5 got us so far, but if we were going to kind of actually make the progress we were anticipating in some of the reports and analysis that was done, we'd actually have to spend more per capita?
Absolutely. I mean, if we want to make transformational change, we have to put... We have to be above $3.89. $3.89 is the minimum. That's why with this proposal, we wouldn't take $6 million and try to stretch it out across the state. It just wouldn't make sense. We would be looking at really little to low impact. So we'd have to reduce the number of grantees to at least have the minimum of $3.89. Could you say that it would be ideal to have more? Absolutely. But $3.89, we know we're going to get outcomes.
Okay, and Mr. Chair, and it sounds like kind of at up to the health department level, there hasn't been any kind of analysis on the effect of a reduction from the $47 million to the, well, I guess it's that amount spread over, no, it's 6 times 4, so half of that amount spread over a longer period of time, right? Twice as long. Is that about what it is, half that amount spread over twice as long? Okay. And have your shop done any analysis of what that's going to mean in terms of cost savings or the effectiveness of the program?
Representative, thank you. We have begun those cost estimates, and we can provide that information. I mean, it's going to be a reduction. There's obviously, we know that, but we can provide that exact information for you very quickly.
That would be helpful. Mr. Chair, I guess one of the things, the sense that this is a linear reduction in effectiveness, or is there kind of a exponential, I'm not sure what the right word, effect. So if we spend half the amount or a quarter of the amount or whatever it would be, are we going to get less than a quarter of the results, do you think?
Mr. Chair, Representative Peterson, I think we're going to get a quarter of the savings. I think we're going to still implement and propose grants that are effective and will show cost savings, but we're going to get about a fourth of the savings.
So there's kind of a linear connection to the savings.
I think it's how you identify linear.
Well, fair enough. All right. Okay, thank you.
Okay. Any other questions? I have one. At one time, I heard the CDC was going to supply us with some staff for this program. Is that true? And will they still do that?
Mr. Chair, they, in their budget cuts, weren't able to provide us with staff. They did provide us with some limited funds that we could use to help in the development of the whole RFP, which will be done and out February 9th, our training needs, seeing that we had no funds allocated for the preparation of the SIP initiative.
Other questions?
One.
So if we're stretching out over 4 years, how long do these grants last?
Mr. Chair, Representative Peterson, that's a great question. They'd last 2 years, so the funding cycle would be a two-year funding cycle. And stretching it out over 4 years, I think that our local public health partners and our tribal governments will tell you is ideal.
Mr. Chair, and I don't have any doubt that having a longer stream of money is ideal. Having half the money probably isn't as much ideal. But I guess the question, so it would be 2 years, and then they'd have to reapply for the next cycle or someone else to get that money.
Right.
Okay.
Any other questions? Seeing none, then I would like to thank the department for their presentation, and the meeting is adjourned.